Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. The early spring of 1994 is considered by many fans to be the pinnacle of winter sports in New York City. The Knicks were on their way to a seven-game classic finals loss to the Rockets, and in hockey, the Rangers were running down a 54-year demon in their quest for a Stanley Cup. Along the way, they'd have to knock off both their neighbors, the Islanders and the Devils. But it was the Eastern Conference Finals against New Jersey that set a new standard in playoff hockey excellence. The Rangers were simply loaded, led by stars like Mark Messier and Brian Leetch. But they were also playing with the weight of the city on their shoulders, keen to end the drought once and for all. The Devils were an upstart with little postseason experience and something of an inferiority complex as they played in the shadow of Manhattan and the Blue Shirts. The series brought together what would be the dominant franchises of the next decade, the original six Rangers desperately hoping to capitalize on their last best opportunity to win the Cup with the world watching, and the Devils, who would go on to turn muscular netminding and the so-called neutral zone trap into three titles over the next 10 years. Joining us to explain what happened in that series, especially in the improbable games 6 and 7, is Tim Sullivan, East sports editor and executive hockey editor with the Associated Press. Sullivan is the author of Battle on the Hudson, The Devils, The Rangers, and the NHL's Greatest Series Ever, which is published by Triumph. Tim Sullivan, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
As you look back on this series now 18 years in the past, what surprised you about the way these two teams met up?
A lot of it is just how you introduced it. It was very much a clash in styles, both on and off the ice, in strategy, in how they built their teams, and in what they really wanted to get out of the series. One team on one side of the river was built to win then and now, had a curse, as you mentioned, hanging over it that was hanging around quite far too long for most fans, one of the most popular franchises in NHL history, regardless of how many titles they had. And you were talking about a fan base that was absolutely in a city that was absolutely desperate for a championship and had all the pieces in place. And so in many, many ways, between their coach and their captain and everything that was going around their team, they had the stars, they had the power, and they just needed to close the deal. The other team on the other side went about things completely differently. They wanted to build an organization from the ground up. They had started in the decade before. They were only 12 years old in 1994 and hadn't tasted any success other than a miracle run to the conference finals in the late 80s. And they built their team under the direction of President GM Lou Lamoriello in an image that wasn't, the trendy thing to do in the mid-90s in the NHL, which was build from the ground up, start with draft picks, acquire people in trades, only the right people and people that would stay a long time as Devils. And they wanted to start a brand, an identity, based around a defensive style system with a new coach, Jacques Lemaire, who came in from the Canadiens. And they wanted to kind of change not only their culture, but the culture of the game in general, and the wins along would come along the way. What they ended up doing is when they faced each other, was a complete contrast from styles of play to philosophy behind the bench to the general managers having different thoughts on the game. And when you add all that up, and the fact that both arenas were 6 miles away, and most fans of both teams who either worked with each other or went to school with each other, some houses were divided in this area, and it was just it made for incredibly dramatic theater. And as you went along in the series, you realized no matter who won, that this area and the game of hockey in general would never be the same.
Now, the Rangers really dominated the Devils in the regular season that year. So how seriously did they take that challenge when they finally met in the Eastern Conference Finals?
I think they knew it was a challenge for sure, but I don't think they thought it was the challenge that was coming. You're absolutely right. They had beaten them all 6 times, and not only was that in their heads, the fact that they had blown right through the Islanders and Capitals in just a little bit more than the minimum 8 victories to get to the third round made things, I don't want to say the Rangers were kicking their feet up, but they felt very, very good and very, very confident that here comes a team that they had already beaten 6 times that had struggled a little bit in the postseason. The Devils beat Buffalo and Boston to get there, the Rangers having beaten the Washington and the Islanders with relative ease. The Rangers were actually sitting back and waiting for days for the Devils Devils to even become their opponent. So I don't think there's any question that confidence snuck into their heads. I don't want to say they were content. They certainly knew and respected the Devils. There's no question about that. But they also knew that they were more talented. They had more at stake. And quite frankly, in this area, not unlike in many others, that rivalries are so prevalent. There's the haves and the have-nots, and the Rangers and Ranger fans have always thought that they were the haves, that they would have more fans in both buildings, and that they would have more coverage, and that they were, quite frankly, supposed to win. So I think from fans on down to the players and the rest of the organization, there was certainly an identity that the Rangers were the better team, and it was just a matter of time.
Now, whatever confidence the Rangers had from a fantastic regular season and the high hopes of what would happen in the spring, they were still wheeling and dealing and changing the makeup of the lines just a couple weeks out from the playoffs. What were some of the major moves they made as it headed toward April?
Neil Smith, the general manager, the coach, and Mike Keenan had a lot of different meetings during the year about how good this team was and what needed to happen for it to get over the hump. They really didn't want and really need, quite frankly, to go get any superstars. What they wanted to do was fill spots here and there. By the trade deadline, they were able to get just about all those spots that they needed to have filled with a lot of role players. Stephan Matteau and Brian Noonan from Chicago are two great examples of players where Mike Keenan coachable players who he knew them from other places and other stops in his career. He knew what they brought to the table, and he had in his mind and collectively brainstorming with Neil Smith as well, had already in place where these guys would play, on what lines and when and for how often, even before the trades were made. And it was a time in the league where Neil Smith was able to find quite a few teams that weren't headed to the playoffs or maybe were on the cusp of the playoffs or weren't expected to do much, with a lot of players who were on the tail end of their contracts. Craig McTavish, another veteran who came over from Edmonton, and then Matteau and Noonan from Chicago. In the end, they wheeled and dealed on trade deadline day and really took a gamble of mixing their chemistry and really changing things around in the locker room. But in the end, it did work. But there's no question. They traded for a lot of players at the end there, and there were some issues of are they panicking? Is this team not as good as we thought they were? In the end, really what it was Neil Smith and Mike Keenan getting the guys they wanted all along. It just took them that long to figure out how to get the deals done and where to put the players on that team.
Now, on the other side, the Devils were known for this new defense that wasn't exactly new, clogging up the lanes in the neutral zone. For someone who might not be a hockey fan or know exactly what the Devils did, could you just explain what it was that they brought to the ice and how that was different or not so different from what had been seen in the NHL before?
It's not that much different from what the Canadiens did ages before the Devils did. The neutral zone trap, or however you want to call it, is a form of defensive style offensive and defensive hockey, where you rely on your players in the neutral zone to kind of siphon off players on the other team before they get a chance to build momentum and rush out of their zone. It's kind of built on the philosophy and the strategy that if you don't have the kind of speed and skill offensively that other teams do, your competition does, this is a way of kind of leveling the playing surface. And what it entails is having one player creep into the other team's zone while the other two forwards and the two defensemen are in the neutral zone, ready to clog up any sort of rush that gets through into their zone. It works sometimes. It doesn't work. It ended up becoming a philosophy that a lot of teams picked up on. The Florida Panthers picked it up almost immediately and went to the Stanley Cup Finals 2 years after 93-94. And it was the most entertaining form of hockey. A lot of people refer to that era as the dead puck era because scoring did go down a little bit, and it kind of strangled, for lack of a better term, some of the higher skilled players. But without question, it was successful. And while the Devils didn't always use that, and the Devils were certainly not given credit for the offensive talent that they did have, it was a system put in place by Jacques Lemaire, who was the new coach, and Larry Robinson, who was the assistant coach, who both came for the Montreal Canadiens, who were both well-versed in this strategy. And when he looked at this roster, when he took this roster over, he knew that he had great defensive players. He knew that he had a very young goaltender, Martin Brodeur, who could, become a Hall of Famer. Obviously, he would. But in the day, in 1993-94, he was a young former first-rounder with potential, but we didn't quite know how good he was going to be. Jacques believed in that system. He believed in the talent that he had. And the players bought in. The thing that gets lost in the neutral zone trap for the Devils, certainly for not so much some of the other teams that used it, is that there was a lot of offensive skill on that team. And when you do clog up the neutral zone, what happens a lot, if this system works well, is breakouts going the other way. A quick turnover with so many players right in that neutral zone sometimes means 3-on-2s and 2-on-1s going into the other opponent's zone, which actually leads to a lot more offense than people think. And the Devils, one thing that people forget about, and they'll tell you, and they tell you this in the book for sure, is that they were number two to the Rangers in offensive production that year. 1993-94, they were second in goals scored. They were very proud of that. So while it was a stigma and a stereotype of the neutral zone trap that kind of gave them a bad name around the league, the reality is that they had quite a boatload of offensive potential, and they certainly used it.
And fast forwarding a bit, they certainly used that offense to take a 3-2 lead in the best of seven series, which led to one of the more famous moments in New York sports history, which is Mark Messier guaranteeing that they would win game six. What people forget, I think, is that the Rangers trailed 2-0 in the game before coming back to win. However, did they find a way to win game six?
That's a good question. When you research a book like this and you watch the game films over and over again, you talk to the players involved, the coaches involved, the GM sitting up and sweating in the press boxes, I can easily tell you that I share the opinion of many involved in and around that book that is game six is easily one of the better games, perhaps one of the best games ever played in NHL history. And I think so many factors played a part of that. And what you have with the Rangers and the Devils, certainly when the Devils are the home team, is that Ranger fans still make it across the river because they have a bigger fan base, because they couldn't get into the Garden back then. For whatever reason, there's always been a lot of Ranger fans at Devils games. And that particular game was probably a 40-60 split for Devils fans. There were a lot of Ranger fans in there. And I think that really helped, was a big part of the comeback. What happened early on was Mike Richter, the goaltender who would eventually lead the Rangers to the Stanley Cup and easily one of the best goaltenders of all time, certainly as an American goaltender, and quite honestly probably played the best game of his life. And the Devils came out charged up. Here they were, as you said, up 3-2. Here's a young team on the verge of their first berth in the Stanley Cup Finals. They had a crowd behind them for the most part, and they were feeling very, very good. They were the guarantee, and all the media coverage was not in their heads early on. They played as a team. They were firing pucks left and right at Mike Richter. And as you said, it was 2-0. But anyone who watched that game and anyone who played that game knew that it probably should have been 5 or 6-0. And if it was even 3 or 4-0 early on, the game would have ended. Richter stole the show. There's absolutely no question about it. Those first 30 minutes, we were talking about up to about the 10-minute mark of the second period, it's probably the best 30 minutes of hockey he's ever played. And he kept his team in it. And along the way, but Mike Keenan called a timeout about halfway through the second period and kind of rallied the troops a little bit. Didn't have to say much because they relied on Mark Messier and they relied on their veteran leadership. There were a lot of players on that team that had won Stanley Cups, even though they hadn't won them for the Rangers. So they knew what they were up against. And then, in hockey, the momentum changes on the bounce of a puck. And what happened after that timeout, John McClain, who was one of the greatest Devils of all time, ended up being their head coach a couple years ago, hit a post that Mike Richter was able to cover about halfway through the second period. If that happened, that went in, it probably would have been a ball game. Probably would have been 3-0, and the Devils would have cruised. He didn't. Alexei Kovalev, who was a young Russian sharpshooter who was really coming into his own as a Ranger, put a slap shot past Martin Brodeur not very long afterwards. The Rangers portion of the crowd erupted. It was 2-1, and the Devils folded to a man. They all say that they had it, and they went into the locker room after that goal, and they were not themselves anymore. They were, for whatever reason, whether it was the crowd, whether it was the fact that they should have been up by more and they weren't, maybe it was just the pressure in general, they did not come out in the third period as the same team that had taken the 3-2 lead, as the same team that was the number two seed in the Eastern Conference. And while they've battled hard in the third period. The rest is New York sports history, as you said. Mark Messier scoring 3 goals. Mike Richter continuing to play the kind of goaltending that kept them in the game for as long as they did. And next thing you know, the Rangers walked off with a win that most people didn't think they deserved or would even see. And next thing you know, there was a game 7. But you're right, absolutely, the roller coaster of emotions what you have with a young team in the Devils back then, when faced with that kind of a situation, the adversity of giving up a goal and feeling that pressure of having to protect a 1-goal lead in 20 minutes as opposed to a 2 or 3-goal lead, certainly got to them. They all agreed to that, and they believed in that, and it certainly affected them the rest of the way.
Now there's a game 7 at Madison Square Garden. The Rangers are home. They have a 1-0 lead, I believe, late, and the Devils find a way to tie it with 7 seconds left or something crazy like that and force an overtime. And yet again, the Rangers refuse to lose at that point. And what happens next?
No question. 7.7 seconds left. There was a lot of pressure. The Devils played it right, and they crashed the net, and they kept in front of the net. And again, it was a bounce of a puck. It was a loose puck that Brian Leetch could have cleared, and he was certainly kicking himself over. And next thing you know, they're going to overtime. And you're absolutely right, though. Two things happened in that intermission. You know, the Devils, you would think, and the common wisdom would say the momentum would carry the Devils into it. Here they were 7 seconds away from being eliminated. They stay alive. They've got all the momentum now. They're back in it. And, realistically, though, they came out, and whether it was they were tired, they couldn't get over the fact that here are their emotions again. They couldn't get over the Kovalev goal in Game 6. They may not have been able to get over the Zalapukhin tying goal in Game 7. For whatever it is, they went back into their defensive shell, and they were not pressing, and they were not pushing the puck, and they were kind of waiting for an opportunity, which is a good theory sometimes. But with the whole season on the line, I think to a man, the Devils, even Coach Jacques Lemaire and Larry Robinson would probably agree that they probably should have been a little bit more aggressive with the puck. On the other side, the Rangers relied on their legends. Mark Messier said a few words in between the periods. Mike Richter said a few words. He was very disappointed. He gave up that goal, and that's what he does. He bounces back, and he wanted to let his team know that he was going to bounce back. But really, in the end, it was Kevin Lowe, a defenseman from the Edmonton Oilers who played with Mark Messier and has plenty of championship experience, plenty of Stanley Cups, and he kind of stood up and he just told the guys, listen, if it was easy, everybody would do it. And, Kevin Lowe is the kind of veteran presence that doesn't speak a lot. But when he does, everyone kind of realizes, wow, if Kevin Lowe, was going to stand up and say something, and we better go out and play. And not that they needed that anyway, but they certainly went out with that in their heads. And they went out, and if you look at those two, 1.5 periods of overtime, the Rangers certainly dominated, and it was just a matter of time. Later on into the second overtime, Stefan Matteau goes around the corner and scores one of the most famous goals in NHL history.
Petisov for the Devils plays it cross ice into the far corner. Matteau swoops in to intercept. Matteau behind the net, swings it in front. He scores! Matteau! And the Rangers have one more hill to climb, baby! But it's Mark Vancouver! The Rangers are headed to the final!
Goal that Marty Brodeur, who's the all-time winningest goalie in NHL history and goes right into the Hall of Fame as soon as he's eligible, gave up probably the worst goal of his career, and he knows that. And it was just a bad bounce. But a lot of the times, the good teams create their own luck, and the Rangers certainly deserved to have the better of the play in those two overtime sessions. And in the end, I think most people realize that the better team won that series and went on to win the Stanley Cup. But the Devils did not let that hang around very long. One of the more emotional, fragile teams during that series, it obviously looked like it. They were able to come back the next year and win the Stanley Cup, and certainly Marty Brodeur and the rest of them all were fueled by that loss. But yes, there's no question. The Rangers dominated those overtimes. It was a matter of time. It was a bad goal, but that's what usually happens in overtime games.
It's been fun to look back on the 94 playoffs. They were certainly memorable. As we speak, the NHL is in the middle of its second lockout in the last decade. And what kind of damage do you think the league is doing to itself, Tim?
It's difficult to measure because there, you know, the amount of coverage right now that the lockout is getting, you know, in both countries is tempered just a little bit by the fact that there's just so much else going on. You know, we went from the World Series to the NFL, really picking up, heading for its stretch run. We got college football now getting a lot of airtime, and I think for the pure, I think that's where it hurts the most right now. For the pure hockey fan, we're always going to know what's going on. We're always going to be in on the lockout. We want to know what the issues are, what the latest is. But for the outside fan, the people that the NHL and this game needs, they're not interested right now. And I think that's you know, a byproduct of both sides, what they're arguing over, and it's a shame because there's a lot of good that's been built over the league since that last lockout. As you said, we're just coming off a Stanley Cup Finals where the Devils played the Kings on two different coasts, two different kind of styles of play, a new team winning the Stanley Cup for the first time. You know, we have hockey on national TV now, and things are, you know, really, really at an all-time high. We have youth hockey at all-time high here in North America, at least, and it's a shame that a lot of these new fans or potential fans or just fringe fans aren't interested right now, and you know, to be honest with you, nobody can blame them.
Well, that's Tim Sullivan of the Associated Press. He's the author of Battle on the Hudson, The Devils, The Rangers, and the NHL's Greatest Series Ever. The book is published by Triumph. Tim, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Ian, for having me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.